Thank you to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode. BetterHelp is the world's largest therapy service, and it's 100% online, so you can access it from anywhere in the world. With BetterHelp, you can tap into a network of over 30,000 licensed and experienced therapists who can help you with a wide range of issues. To get started, you just answer a few questions about your needs and preferences in therapy. That way, BetterHelp can match you with the right therapist from their network. Then you can talk to your therapist however you feel comfortable, whenever it's convenient for you. If your therapist isn't the right fit for any reason, you can switch to a new therapist with no additional cost. With BetterHelp, you get the same professionalism and quality you expect from in-office therapy, but with a therapist who is custom picked for you, more scheduling flexibility, and at a more affordable price. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/howtosurvivesociety. That's betterhelp.com/howtosurvivesociety. Hello, survivors. This is your girl, Abby Ayola Williams, and you're now listening to How to Survive Society. How to Survive Society is a weekly podcast that features survivors. These are people that have been through the ringers in life. They've been through hell and back, but they choose to stay positive. They choose to win. They choose to thrive, and they choose to survive. So let's get right into it. Hello, survivors. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of How to Survive Society. Today I have Max. Is it Friedman?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Perfect. Thank you. I have Max Friedman, and is the author of Painful Joy. So we're going to talk more about his book, his upbringing, being born to Polish Jews after the Holocaust and all those, and what it entails, and his twin sons and how their upbringing was and things like that. So hi, Max, can you please introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm a second generation Holocaust survivor. And I think what that means is that I survived my parents' survival. My parents were Holocaust survivors in that they both had families before my sister and myself. They had large families. They lived in Poland and the southeastern part of Poland. And they met only after the war, after their liberation from Bergen-Belsen, the last of a number of camps, concentration camps, that in which they were imprisoned during virtually the entire war. They suffered greatly. My father had a wife and two little girls who were murdered. My mother had a husband. She had many brothers and a sister. The sister survived, and that's only because my mother, at a selection in Auschwitz, actually saved her life.
Wow, that's so sad.
That's the short version of what they went through and what they lost, which is virtually everyone they ever loved and everything they ever knew.
Wow. So thank God there were survivors and they were able to meet each other after what happened to them prior. So what do you think helped them to survive when only so few made it?
Right. The statistics for their part of Poland and were something like 3-4% of all the Jews who lived there. And there were millions of Jews, actually, except for the United States, more Jews than any other place in the world at the time. They survived, I think, in a number of different ways. First, I think they never looked to the future. I found that even after the war, obviously, and they had a second family, my sister and myself, they remained survivors. They didn't look toward what would be. They only looked at what was. And I think by doing that, they were able to stay in the moment, in a sense, and deal with whatever risks they had to take, whatever accommodations they had to make, whatever beatings they had to take, and whatever losses they had to endure. And I think that helped them. The other thing that I think helped them, though I'm sure others did much the same, was that they rewrote their story. My mother had a fantasy life after the war, and I think during the war and even before, because she actually, as a very young girl, was a refugee from World War I, and her family escaped to Prague when fighting took place right where they lived in Poland, and lived on the streets of Prague and in refugee camps for 5 years ever before they ever came back to Poland. So I think what she did was make up another story for herself throughout her life. She used to tell us that she and her first husband had a dance studio, and they had a lot of money, and they had a wonderful life, even though they were only married a year before the war began, but we didn't even know that at the time. And it turned out she never had a dance studio. They were poor. Her first husband, made luggage, and she took in wash so that they had enough money to eat. My father told me nothing about the war, except the last time he saw his wife and two little girls, and that was the first time I ever even knew very much about any of that. And he told it to me once when I was 20 years old. And it turned out that his story, while it had some pieces that were true, were also not, it didn't happen the way he had told me. And I think that was because he felt a great deal of guilt and shame for surviving when his wife and two little girls were taken to Auschwitz and gassed. He actually was in a concentration camp at the time, 300 miles away in Germany. So they spent the rest of their lives remembering that and recalling not what was, but what they had wanted it to be. And so that was another survival experience that they had. And I started to think about it actually today. And I think what ended up happening was that they, and then my sister and I, lived in what I would call the great accommodation. We accommodated ourselves to everything. We were not that interested in change. My sister avoided change at any cost her whole life. It was terrifying. And my mother and father lived the way they had lived before. We very frugally, we never had much mm-hmm. money. We were actually fairly poor though most of our lives. But they took what was and tried to make the best of it.
Wow, that must have been something for you to find out that some of the stories that your parents told you weren't even true.
Yeah, so was shocking. It was shocking, yeah. But I came to understand it. I wasn't angry at them. There was nothing to be angry at. These were mm-hmm. two people who had gone through more than anyone could imagine.
Yeah. Wow. So you said, so after you migrated to US in 1952 with your sister and your parents, is that correct?
Yes, yes. We were in Sweden. My sister and I were born there. My mm-hmm. parents met in a camp, actually, in Sweden. There were alien camps that were set up by the Swedes. They took about 6,000 survivors of Bergen-Belsen, Jewish survivors, to Sweden to recuperate. And then they were expected to leave Sweden after 6 months to somewhere else, whether to go back to Poland or to find a country somewhere else that would take them. And we stayed in Sweden because no one else would take us. for 7 years. And my parents worked there and we were born there. And then when we came to the U.S., my father worked as a warehouse clerk his entire life in the same place. And my mother and father used to fight a lot about that because my mother would always want him to be more ambitious. And he was a very smart guy and a very nice man. But I think as part of this great accommodation, while I'm sure he took a lot of risks during his imprisonment, during the war, after the war, he didn't want to take any risks. He wanted just to be safe, and he wanted us to just be safe. So we lived in Coney Island, which is an area in Brooklyn, big amusement park, and we never went on any ride. We weren't allowed to because they were afraid for us. They were the original helicopter parents, if anyone could imagine that at its most extreme level.
But you can kind of understand why.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We didn't like it when we were young, but we came to understand it. And I think we mimicked them in some ways, too.
Yeah, I could understand why, you know, because they've been through so much, they've lost so much that they just want to feel safe and do the same thing over and over again. Just, you know, no, they don't want any changes because to them, changes bring heartache and it brings death. And, you know, so yeah. I can understand why they made you guys, you know, they were the helicopter parents that they were, you know, so you just have to give them a little bit of grace. And I'm happy that you kind of understood why they had to do that with you guys. So after you grew up in the 50s in the United States, but you said you weren't like a normal child. What does that mean?
No, my mother, because of the concentration camps, had eating disorders. So she had bulimia. So we lived in like a 2.5-room apartment and facing an alley. And we watched television a lot, my sister and I did. And we just looked, and television in those days was an idealized Ozzie and Harriet and Father Knows Best and all of that. But it was a different world. And when we went outside, we saw a different world, even in school. And we would come home, and we would come home to a world where it was a sad world. There wasn't a lot of laughing. There was a lot of arguing and fighting. And they fought about money mostly. And they never really were meant for each other. And it's because I think a lot of survivors actually ended up marrying other survivors because those other people were the only ones who could understand what they had gone through. And so the people we saw, the few people we saw socially, or my parents saw socially, were survivors as well. And so it was a very sort of muted life. It was a life not of color, but of race. And we would have to wake up our parents quite a lot from their nightmares. They were suffering from PTSD. No one ever told us a bedtime story. We were never read to, but we both became, at least when we were younger, and my mother, my sister continues, voracious readers. And my mother would only tell us about concentration camps. She didn't tell us about what happened to her before the war, what her family was like or anything. She just told us about the camps, and that was our bedtime stories. So it clearly had an effect in making us sort of fearful as well.
Wow. So after you grew up in the 1950s in Colin Allen and stuff, then you wanted to be a journalist, right?
I like the idea of I would find newspapers on the subways or in the street, and I love to read about the outside world. I learned most of my English, I think, my early English. We were only spoken to in Yiddish, when we were young. And yeah. my sister would speak Yiddish back to my parents, but I would only speak to them in English. I had decided at a fairly early age that I needed to survive, again, their survival. And it was instinctual, I think, but I rejected, in a sense, their lives. And I rejected the reality around us. And so mm-hmm. I learned English from watching Walter Cronkite. And I would, at a very young age, actually go on the subway and go into New York, into Manhattan, and make believe that I was an adult already. And I would put on a little bow tie and walk around with a little envelope and wore up and down office building elevators. And my father would be asleep, my sister and my mother would be out looking at department stores, but not buying anything because we didn't have any money. And I would be in the city at age 7 and 8. It was an unusual world. But I decided that I really liked Manhattan. I liked the world around me. And I wanted to write about it. And it was the only thing I could do as I grew up. It was the only thing that's, I wanted to be a chemist. I wanted to be all kinds of other things, but I was not good in math. And I like to write, and that's what I decided I was going to do one way or another.
That is good. So, but then you ended up not being a journalist, correct?
Yeah, I became
a writer.
I guess a writer, but a survivor in the sense that I decided that once we had kids, certainly that I did a lot of freelance writing. But mm-hmm. once we had kids, I decided I needed to have a livelihood, not like my father's livelihood, but something better mm-hmm. and something mm-hmm. easier so I could be around the kids, because I did start working at a newspaper, and you work the night shift and you do all kinds of other stuff, which I actually wasn't ready to do. I wanted to, again, be focused on my family more than anything and give them a good life, or help give a good life. My wife worked as well. So I became a writer. I did a lot of freelance writing, and then I worked for a big company and ran their editorial communications. And I worked for a while for public television as well, working for Bill Moyers.
Wow, that's pretty an accomplishment.
Yeah, it was great. It was wonderful. It was a magical time.
So here it says that you were father of twins,
right?
And at that time in the 70s, there was not that much twins, so
right. It was very hard to find a twin stroller. There were no twin strollers. It was hard to get through supermarket doors, right?
Yeah, I can imagine. But now it's like there's a lot of twin stuff and bigger doors and things like that.
Right.
So how are your twins and your wife?
They're doing well. They're boys, they were fraternal twins. My one lives in China mm-hmm. with our two grandchildren. One of our grandchildren actually is with us now, living in the United States for this year, and started high school here where we live. Uh-huh. And my son there runs strategy for a big medical device company, and they've been there for 12 years. My other son got a law degree, and the one in China got an MBA, got a law degree, and he did human rights work, and he works on global health equity policy out of the Georgetown Law School, where he's a scholar there.
Wow, that's really good. You and your wife did such a great job with your twins, and I'm happy that you were able to, even though you grew up not the way that you would have liked to grow up, but at least you made yourself, more comfortable and you learned, you were more disciplined and you wanted a different life for your family and you were able to achieve that. So kudos to you.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, and I decided one day, though we didn't know much about my parents, because they didn't tell us, my father virtually nothing, my mother just about the camps, but nothing else about her life. 5 years or 6 years ago now, I guess, I decided when my grandson asked me about them, I decided to try. I was embarrassed that I didn't know much. And so I spent the last 5 years finding out who they were and what they experienced and where they lived and wrote this book as a result.
That's amazing. So is there one thing you hope readers will be able to take away from your book? It's called Painful Joy.
So yeah, what is, I think, that two thing? Things, if I... Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure.
Two things. One, I think I want people to understand, because I think you meet these two people and they're strangers. I mean, you know, and I give them a name and I give them a birthplace and I give them a family or their first families and their nuclear families. And you get to learn what life was like for them, because the book also describes the world around them at the time. Mm-hmm. And you find out, basically, you go on this journey of my own journey of discovery with them. And they grow up and things happen to them. Some good things, some very bad things. And then by the end of the book, I think you get to feel something for them. They become real people, not just another statistic of, you know, 6 million Jews die and a few hundred thousand survive, but real people who experience life. And I want people to understand what hate can do. So that's the first thing. I think we live in a very divisive time and we worry about authoritarianism and we see it happening in other parts of the world. And we've seen genocides too many times already, even since the Holocaust, in Africa especially, and in Asia to some degree. And so I want them to come away with understanding hate, and that hate could actually be around the corner at any time and it can do horrible things, and understanding empathy, because I think at the end of the reading a book like this, you feel for these people who go through so much and still persevere somehow, and even with all their deficits and all their weaknesses, they're strong enough to start all over again and to start a new life together, even with somebody who maybe they wouldn't have picked the first time around. So I'd like people to come away with empathy and with a better understanding of not only how to survive, but at some point how to thrive.
Yes, that's the key. Don't only survive, also thrive. That's a very key point. So where can people get the book?
Amazon is probably the easiest place. I think the hardcover is on sale these days. So, but Amazon, and it comes in hardcover, softcover, Kindle ebook. If you have Kindle Unlimited, you basically get it for free.
Okay. So for the listeners out there, the book is called Painful Joy. You can get it on Amazon, in Kindle, hardcover, softcover. So you have options. Before we go, is there any last thing you would like the listeners to know?
I would just like people to understand as well that things can happen very quickly. And that I once asked a guide who took us around to find some of these places and who spoke Polish, so we could understand what was going on and what people were thinking and talking about, how my father could have started a family in the face of what was already happening in the late 30s in Poland, the same thing that was happening next door and worse, even in Germany. And he said, well, first, no one knew that it could be this bad. And second, what does one expect of somebody except to try to sort of go on with their lives as though there's nothing else to do? Where were they going to go? And I think the fact that things can change so quickly, and that that hate and divisiveness and democracy under threat can accelerate what is perhaps an underlying sense, whether it's racism or anti-Semitism or anything else. And I want people to be aware that things can turn very quickly if we're not careful and if we're not active in trying to do something about it.
That is a great tip. You're right about that. The world is very, very, very decisive. There's a lot of division in the world right now. And I just hope that we as people will come together and stop trying to divide each other with religion, race, ethnic background. You know, we're all human at the end of the day, right? So I guess we just have to find a common ground and come together. So I would like to say thank you, Max, for coming on. And I hope you have a great day. Say hello to your family, your grandchildren, and thank you for giving us that one point, like don't just survive, thrive also. So thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Big, big thank you to our guest for today. And if you would like to learn more about today's topic, please go on howtosurvivesociety.com. There you can get some life skills courses and some merchandise, and contact me if you would like to be a guest on the show. So thank you so much for tuning in, and have yourself a lovely day. Today is a great day to start your own podcast. Whether you're looking for a new marketing channel, have a message you want to share with the world, or just think it would be fun to have your own talk show, podcasting is an easy, inexpensive, and fun way to expand your reach online. Buzzsprout is hands down the easiest and best way to launch, promote, and track your podcast. Your show can be online and listed in all the major podcast directories like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, and more, within minutes of finishing your recording. Podcasting isn't hard when you have the right partners, and the team at Buzzsprout is passionate about helping you succeed. Join over 100,000 podcasters already using Buzzsprout to get their message out to the world. Let's create something great together. So if you ever need help to start your own podcast, reach out to me. And then, you know what you can do also? You know, you can follow the link in the show notes, that lets Buzzsprout know that I sent you, so you can get a $20 Amazon gift card when you sign up for a paid plan. And you can also support the show that way. So yeah, so if you're looking to start your own podcast, reach out to me, follow the link under the notes show, and you'll be able to sign up and get a $20 Amazon card. Yeah.